What happens when a nation, founded on a sacred covenant, forgets its origins and begins to drift, trading divine guidance for human impulse, doing whatever feels right in its own eyes? Cities fall, consumed by fire and strife. Unlikely heroes rise from the dust. Enemies mass on all sides, and the people, time and time again, cry out in a desperation born of self-inflicted pain. This is not a quaint fairy tale spun for comfort. This is raw history, a chronicle of war, profound betrayal, savage vengeance, and astonishing miracles. It is the true, unfiltered story of deeply flawed warriors, of fearless, strategically brilliant women, and of a persistent God who simply refuses to abandon the people he has claimed. From lion slayers battling wilderness beasts to humble women assassinating generals with a tent peg, from the tragic consequences of twisted, irreversible vows to a king-crushing woman wielding a mere millstone, this is arguably the wildest, darkest, and most relentlessly human book in the entire Holy Scriptures. This is the book of Judges, laid bare like you have never witnessed it before. After Joshua died, the resolute leader who had successfully ushered the Israelites across the Jordan and into the Promised Land, an eerie, unsettling silence descended upon the 12 tribes. There was no Moses to intercede, no Joshua to command, just lingering questions. Who would dare to lead them now? They looked out across the mountains, the deep valleys, and the fortified cities, places still largely controlled by hostile enemies. They possessed the deed to the land, yes, but they did not yet possess all of it. The campaign was far from over. So, confronted by this massive vacuum of authority, they did the only thing they knew to do. They sought divine counsel. Lord, they implored, their voices laced with uncertainty. Who among us should be the first to march out and fight against the formidable Canaanites? And God answered immediately and precisely, "Let Judah go first. I have already delivered this land into their hands." The directive was simple, direct, and undeniably divine. The battle-ready warriors of the tribe of Judah then turned to the neighboring tribe of Simeon and proposed an alliance. "Fight alongside us," they said. "Help us seize our assigned portion of the inheritance, and when it is your turn to fight for your lot, we will gladly fight for you." That was the definition of brotherhood in those days, a shared commitment to fulfill the covenant. So, they advanced together, and their first major test arrived at a place called Bezek, where they were met by a king named Adoni-Bezek. He was a seasoned warrior, known throughout the region for his brutality and the terror he inspired. But the mighty hand of God was clearly with Judah. They utterly crushed Adoni-Bezek's forces. They captured the king himself. And in an act that was both shocking in its brutality and profoundly symbolic, they severed his thumbs and his big toes. Barbaric? Perhaps. But listen to what the king confessed as he lay bleeding, his power instantly stripped away. "I did this very thing to 70 kings," he stated. "I mutilated their thumbs and toes, forcing them to grovel beneath my table. And now, precisely as I inflicted it upon others, God has repaid me." They brought him to Jerusalem, where he died, utterly shorn of his crown and his power. Judah's army, emboldened, pushed forward, marching relentlessly into the rugged hills and sun-baked deserts. Everywhere they went, the Lord was with them, granting fierce victory. But not every battle was winnable, and not every corner of the land surrendered easily. When they finally faced enemies equipped with iron chariots, armored machines of war that guaranteed battlefield superiority, they faltered. Even Judah, as bold and divinely directed as they were, could not overcome that technological terror. Still, God was moving. Somewhere else, an old warrior was preparing to make one final, indelible mark. Caleb. Yes, that Caleb, the venerable leader who had spied out the land alongside Joshua decades earlier in the days of Moses, now stood tall. He issued a challenge that echoed the heroic age. "Whoever successfully attacks and takes the formidable city of Kiriath Sepher will be granted the honor of marrying my daughter, Aksa." It was a challenge paired with a magnificent reward. A young man named Othniel stepped forward. He was Caleb's nephew, but he didn't rely on his family name or connections. He relied on sheer, unadulterated courage. He fought, he conquered, and he earned Aksa's hand. She was no ordinary bride. She was bold, savvy, and strategic. "Ask my father for land that has water," she instructed Othniel. Understanding that land without life-sustaining springs was useless, and Caleb, recognizing her wisdom, generously gave her both the upper and the lower springs. It wasn't just property. It was life, abundance, and security. The tribes pressed on. Judah and Simeon, remaining unified, conquered a city called Zephath, burned it down completely, and renamed it Hormah, meaning destruction. A stern warning carved in fire and ash. But this shared obedience was short-lived. Not all the tribes followed through on their divine mandate. Benjamin found themselves unable to expel the deeply entrenched Jebusites in Jerusalem. So, instead of routing them, they made the fatal decision to live beside them. The people of Joseph spied on the city of Bethel. They found a man, brokered a treacherous deal. "Show us the way into the city, and we promise we will not kill you." He helped. They spared him, and he moved away to build a new city, which he called Luz. Mercy, perhaps, but more likely a clear sign that they were beginning the dangerous slide toward compromise. Tribe after tribe followed the same path of spiritual decay and strategic failure. Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali. None of them fully cleansed the land. They allowed the Canaanites to remain among them. Some even forced them into indentured labor, a shortcut to temporary power, a strategy explicitly not blessed by God. The tribe of Dan tried to conquer their lot, but the powerful Amorites were too strong. They pushed Dan back, forcing them up into the high hills. The fertile valleys, the richest places, were lost to them. Only much later, when the tribe of Joseph grew disproportionately strong, did they manage to force the Amorites into servitude. It was a late victory, but it was far short of the complete obedience God had called for. And so, the stage was set for tragedy. A people scattered, marred by half-victories, plagued by divided loyalties, occupying a land only partially claimed but fully dangerous. The Israelites were learning a bitter truth the hard way. Having a promise does not automatically mean you are living it out. God had given them the land, but now came the true test. Would they trust him fully? Would they obey without compromise, even when it was difficult? Would they remember the mighty hand that led them out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, and across the Jordan? Or would they simply begin to forget? That is how the book of Judges truly begins. Not with a crown or a conquest, but with a question mark hanging heavy over the nation. Who will lead when there is no king? Before long, something extraordinary cut through the silence. Out of the dust of compromise, out of a generation already forgetting their sacred roots, God sent a messenger. An angel of the Lord descended, appearing not to a king or a secluded prophet, but directly to the assembled people themselves. He traveled from Gilgal, that sacred place of memory where Israel had first set foot in the promised land, where memorial stones had been stacked in eternal remembrance. Step by step, the angel walked until he reached a small town called Bochim. There he stood and then he spoke. His voice cut through the heavy air like lightning in a still sky. "I brought you up out of Egypt. I personally led you into the land I swore I would give your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you." The people stopped, stunned into silence. "I told you clearly, do not make covenants with the people of this land. Break down their altars. But you have not obeyed me." The silence deepened, becoming thick with guilt. The angel's voice cracked, not in weakness, but in profound, sorrowful disappointment. "What is this you have done?" He wasn't asking because he lacked knowledge. He was asking so that the gravity of their betrayal would echo in their own souls. "So now I declare, I will no longer drive these nations out before you. They will remain, and they will become traps to ensnare you. Their gods will become sharp, agonizing snares for your feet." The words fell like spiritual thunder. A covenant had been utterly broken, not by God, but by his people, and the terrible consequences would not be delayed. Suddenly, something strange occurred. Something raw, honest, and deeply human. The Israelites lifted their voices and wept. Right there, in the presence of divine disappointment and grief, they cried out with the agony of a guilty heart. They named the place Bochim, the Weepers, And there, in that sorrowful place, they offered sacrifices to the Lord, not out of habit or cold obligation, but out of genuine mourning, out of brokenness, and out of a desperate desire to return to Him. But would this repentance last? Almost immediately, the devastating cycle began again. Joshua, the faithful leader and warrior of promise, had died. He was buried in the hills of Timnath-Heres, a resting place among the inheritance he helped secure. With him passed an entire generation that had witnessed God's magnificent power firsthand. They had walked through parting waters. They had tasted the miraculous victory of walls falling at a mere shout. But the next generation, they did not know the Lord. They had not seen the Red Sea split in two. They had not seen the sun stand still over Gibeon. They had not stood trembling at Mount Sinai. And so they began to forget. They forgot the power of the one who brought them out of Egypt. They forgot the tender mercy that rained down manna every morning. They forgot the burning justice leveled against Pharaoh. And into that dangerous void of forgetting, foreign idols crept in: Baal, Ashtaroth, foreign names with tempting material promises. The people bowed low to carved wood and cold stone, to false gods that had eyes but could not see, ears but could not hear, mouths but could not speak a single true word. The Lord saw, and He was consumed by righteous anger. "These people," He declared, "have turned away. They follow false gods. They openly break my covenant." So He withdrew His protective hand. No more easy victories. No more guaranteed triumphs. Now, when they marched to war, they fell swiftly. When they cried out for help, only agonizing silence echoed back from the heavens. Yet, even in judgment, God's deep mercy flickered like a stubborn flame refusing to be extinguished. He raised up judges, not kings draped in golden robes, not political rulers, but humble, flawed men and women who were suddenly filled with the Spirit of the Lord. These judges rose up. They fought. They delivered the people. And for a short time, the nation followed God. But as soon as the judge died, the people slid right back into sin, worse sin, deeper rebellion. It was a cycle. Devastating, maddening, and tragically predictable. Obedience, forgetting, idolatry, defeat, crying out, salvation, temporary peace, then forgetting again. The Lord watched. He knew the fickleness of their hearts. And He spoke again. "Because this nation has violated my covenant, I will no longer drive out the nations Joshua left behind. I will use them to test Israel to see if they will commit to walking in my ways." So the Canaanites remained. The Philistines, the Sidonians, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, they were all left in place. Not because God was weak, but because His people were. They had failed the test of faith, and the dangerous world would press in closer still. The promised land was filled, but it was not free. God's people lived among their enemies, enemies they were commanded to drive out. Enemies who whispered with foreign tongues, who bowed to carved gods, enemies who waited patiently for Israel's next lapse. And the Israelites began to change. They didn't just live alongside the nations. They married into them. They gave their daughters to pagan sons and took foreign brides for themselves. And with those destructive unions came something far worse than shared homes or customs. They began to worship false gods. The children of the God of Abraham were now kneeling to Baal, burning incense to Ashtaroth, building altars to outright lies. So the Lord, whose heart burned with both justice and jealousy for His people, allowed the consequence to fall. From the east came a terrible king, Cushan-Rishathaim of Mesopotamia. His ominous name meant double wickedness, and he lived up to every single letter. He crossed borders, took cities, dominated tribes, and for 8 long, agonizing years, Israel served him. Not as allies, not as neighbors, but as slaves. God's people, once freely delivered, now lived under a cruel and foreign fist. But suffering has a strange, powerful way of stirring memory. And the people remembered. They remembered Egypt and how God set them free. They remembered the Red Sea and how it parted. They remembered their covenant. And from that deep place of pain, they did what desperate people must do. They cried out not to Baal, not to Ashtaroth. They cried out to the Lord. And God, merciful even when wronged, heard them. He raised up a man, not a prophet or a prince, but a seasoned warrior. His name was Othniel, the very same Othniel who had taken Kiriath-Sepher and won the heart of Aksa. The same Othniel who had once been hungry for a challenge, now filled with the very spirit of the Lord, rose to become Israel's first judge. He did not come with chariots or armies of thousands. He came with a holy fire in his bones and the hand of God on his back. Othniel led the people. He rallied the tribes. He stood against Cushan-Rishathaim, the double wicked king. And he fought, not with fear, not with compromise, but with absolute faith. God granted him total victory. Othniel struck down the enemy. He shattered their domination. And Israel was free again. Peace swept over the land like a fresh, cleansing wind. Not for a day, not for a season, but for 40 full years. A generation grew up under Othniel's leadership. Safe, strong, and faithful. And then he died quietly without drama, without ever establishing a permanent throne. Just a man who obeyed God and gave his people peace. But peace is dangerously fragile when memory is allowed to fade. Without Othniel to lead them, the Israelites began to forget again. Forget who freed them. Forget who blessed them. Forget who they were. Othniel was gone, and with him the discipline, the spiritual vision, and the moral backbone of the people. Israel fell again, like a house without a foundation. They deliberately committed evil in God's sight, not out of ignorance, but out of habit, out of choice, out of outright rebellion. So the Lord gave them over to a new king, from an old enemy, Eglon, the king of Moab, a man whose reputation was defined by his immense appetite. He allied himself with the Ammonites and the Amalekites. Together they struck like a storm. They crossed the Jordan and seized the city of palm trees, Jericho, the very first place Israel had conquered. Now it was lost. And for 18 long, miserable years, Israel served Eglon, a man whose opulent throne groaned under the weight of his indulgence, a man whose stomach grew while Israel's spirit shrank, until once again the people remembered. Again they cried out, and again mercy answered. This time, God raised up a man named Ehud, from the tribe of Benjamin. His name meant son of the right hand. But Ehud was notably left-handed. That peculiar detail mattered profoundly, because the enemy would never expect what came next. Ehud cunningly fashioned a dagger, a short, twin-edged sword, perfect for concealment. He strapped it to his right thigh, underneath his clothing, a place no guard would ever think to check on a left-handed man. He then joined a diplomatic delegation sent to bring tribute to King Eglon. Coins, precious goods, offerings of forced loyalty. They bowed. They presented the treasure. And then Ehud turned, as if to leave. But just outside the palace doors, he paused, turned back, and spoke softly to the guards. "I have a secret message for the king." It was a whisper of mystery, designed to pique curiosity. Eglon, arrogant, curious, and utterly unaware, dismissed his attendants and guards. Now it was just Ehud and the corpulent king, alone in the cool chamber. Ehud leaned in close. "I have a message from God for you." And as Eglon, his wide frame rising awkwardly from the throne in anticipation, stood exposed, Ehud reached. He did not reach to the usual place, the left side, but to the right, to the hidden dagger on his thigh. He drove the blade deep, burying it entirely into Eglon's massive belly. So deep was the strike that the thick layers of fat closed over the blade, pulling the handle in until it disappeared completely. Eglon fell dead on the floor. Ehud calmly locked the doors behind him and walked away, unnoticed. Later, the guards returned. The doors were still locked. They waited patiently, assuming their king was relieving himself in privacy. They laughed. They whispered. They delayed fatally. Until finally, driven by worry, they opened the door and found their king lifeless and bloated. Too late. Ehud had escaped. He made his way swiftly to the mountains of Ephraim, and there he blew a sharp trumpet blast. The sound echoed like thunder down the rocky hillsides. The people gathered. Their fear instantly turned to fiery resolve, their shame to courage. Ehud raised his voice and shouted, Follow me, for the Lord has delivered Moab into our hands. And they charged. They struck down 10,000 Moabitish soldiers, strong, seasoned, ruthless men. Not a single enemy escaped the slaughter. That day, Moab was decisively defeated, and once again the land had peace. This time for 80 glorious years. 80 years of quiet stability. That is a very long time to forget. But forget they did. The Israelites once again turned away from God, and he gave them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan. Jabin ruled from Hazor, a massively fortified city in the north. His general, Sisera, commanded 900 iron chariots. These were not merely machines of war. They were terrifying symbols of absolute technological dominance. Every time Israel attempted to rise up, those chariots rolled in, crushing hope, burning fields, and scattering courage. For 20 years, Sisera relentlessly oppressed God's people. 20 years of paralyzing fear, 20 years of prayers offered only in silence, until the cries began again. This time, God didn't raise a male warrior. He raised a woman. Her name was Deborah. She was a prophetess, a judge, a powerful voice of God in a time of spiritual noise and confusion. She didn't sit in a palace. She sat beneath a simple palm tree between Ramah and Bethel, an open-air courtroom where people came with complex disputes and left with clear, divine wisdom. She was respected. She was trusted. She was absolutely fearless. One day, she sent for a man named Barak, a warrior who was capable and strong, yet visibly hesitant. Deborah looked him directly in the eye. God commands you. Take 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun. Go to Mount Tabor. Sisera will come to meet you there, and the Lord will deliver him completely into your hands. Barak didn't say no, but he didn't say an immediate yes either. Instead, he said, I will go, but only if you come with me. Deborah didn't flinch. I will go, she affirmed. But because you ask this, the ultimate honor of the victory will not be yours. The Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman. And so the two marched out. Mount Tabor stood tall, a lonely hill rising majestically above the vast Jezreel Valley. Barak's 10,000 men climbed it, waiting. From the valley below, Sisera's chariots thundered forward, iron wheels glinting menacingly in the sun. Then Deborah gave the signal, Go! This is the day the Lord gives Sisera into your hands. The Lord goes before you. Barak and his army charged down the mountain slope. But they were not alone. Something unseen moved with them. God sent a furious storm. Rain poured down from the sky, instantly turning the fertile valley floor into heavy, treacherous mud that swallowed the wheels of Sisera's iron chariots. His invincible war machines instantly turned into useless, sunken wreckage. Confusion erupted among his troops, and they were struck down, every single one, except Sisera. He fled on foot, running wildly through the fields, past the trees, his heart pounding in panic. He ran until he saw a tent. It belonged to Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Her people maintained a precarious peace agreement with King Jabin, or so Sisera foolishly thought. Jael stepped out. Her voice was kind, her eyes were calm. Come in, my lord, she invited. Do not be afraid. He entered the tent. She covered him with a heavy blanket. I'm thirsty, he whispered. She gave him milk, not water, inducing a deeper relaxation. Stand at the door, he muttered, his eyes closing. If anyone comes, say I'm not here. And he slept. The mighty general, the master of the iron chariots, the terror of Israel, was now utterly vulnerable. Jael moved silently. She took a tent peg in one hand and a heavy workman's hammer in the other. She knelt beside him, raised her arm, and drove the sharp spike through his temple, pinning him to the ground. He never woke. When Barak arrived, breathless and searching for his foe, Jael stepped out. Come, she said, her voice still calm. I will show you the man you are looking for. And there he lay dead. The enemy was defeated by two women. One with divine wisdom, one with unexpected, brutal boldness. And that day, God gave Israel a resounding victory over Jabin, king of Canaan. Slowly, His grip on the land faded until he was utterly no more. Not every victory ends with a battle cry. Some end with a song. After Sisera fell, after Jael's tent peg silenced Canaan's greatest threat, after peace returned to the land, Deborah did not just move on. She sang. With Barak standing humbled at her side, she lifted her voice, not to glorify herself or her warriors, but to glorify the Lord. And what a song it was. A song of remembrance, a song of warning, a profound song of worship. When the princes of Israel take the lead, she sang. When the people willingly offered themselves, praise the Lord, Deborah remembered the fear. She remembered how the roads were deserted, how travelers avoided the dangerous highways, how village life had ceased in Israel. Until I, Deborah, arose. Arose a mother in Israel. Not a general, not a queen, but a mother, because what she fought for was not territory or glory, but the future, safety, and faithfulness of her people. She noted the depth of their degradation. God chose new leaders when war came to the gates, but not a shield or spear could be found among 40,000 in Israel. That's how low they had sunk. No weapons, no confidence, just hiding in fear. But some stood up, and Deborah praised them by name. From Ephraim came the root of Amalek. Benjamin followed close behind. From Machir marched down commanders. From Zebulun came those who bear the officer's staff. She honored the tribes who came forward and vehemently called out those who didn't. Why did Reuben stay among the sheep pens? Gilead stayed safely across the Jordan. Dan lingered idly with the ships. Asher remained by the coast. In the face of existential danger, they chose comfort and self-interest. Yet others rose to the occasion. The people of Zebulun risked their very lives. So did Naphtali on the heights of the field. Then she turned her eyes to the heavens. From the heavens the stars fought. From their courses they fought against Sisera. Even creation had joined the battle. The Kishon River swelled with a divine flood. Chariots drowned. Panic spread. And Jael, oh Jael, Deborah saved her highest, most poetic praise for the woman with the tent peg. Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, most blessed of tent-dwelling women. He asked for water and she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She stretched her hand for the tent peg, her right hand for the heavy hammer, and she struck Sisera. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. But even in triumph, Deborah did not forget the deep human cost of war. She imagined Sisera's mother, waiting at home. Through the lattice window peered Sisera's mother. She cried out, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why are the hoofbeats of his horses delayed? She waited, but he would not return. And finally, Deborah sang the closing plea that echoed into eternity. So may all your enemies perish, Lord, but may all who love you be like the sun when it rises in its strength. And then the land had peace for 40 glorious years. Not because of kings, not because of vast armies, but because of one woman who listened intently to God and another who acted with decisive, terrifying courage. The land had peace until it didn't. 40 years passed after Deborah's song, and once again, Israel forgot. They did evil. They turned from God, and the Lord handed them over, this time to the Midianites. And the Midianites weren't just conquerors. They were devourers. Every year, precisely at harvest time, they came like an endless swarm of locusts. Camel riders and marauding thieves descended upon them like a relentless, suffocating wave. They were not content merely to besiege fortified cities. They implemented a scorched earth strategy, sweeping across the open country, devouring the harvests, butchering the flocks of sheep, confiscating every beast of burden, and leaving behind only desolation. The once fertile land was reduced to empty, dust-choked fields, trees stripped bare, and the populace, starving and broken, forced into the humiliating refuge of hidden caves and rocky mountain fissures. For 7 grueling years this tyranny persisted, 7 years of witnessing their oppressors gorge themselves on the fruits of Israel's agonizing labor, 7 years of profound, chilling silence emanating from the heavens above, 7 years of paralyzing dread. Finally, when their endurance snapped, The people raised their voices in a desperate, unified cry, and God did indeed respond, though not in the manner they had desperately imagined. There was no thunderous arrival of a celestial army, no anointed, majestic king. Instead, the answer came as a quiet, surprising whisper directed at a man named Gideon. Gideon was not found at the head of warriors, nor was he standing defiantly on a watchtower. He was humiliatingly tucked away inside a winepress, a deep pit usually reserved for stomping grapes, secretly flailing out the wheat, trying to hide his meager efforts from the watchful eyes of the Midianite patrols, simply trying to cling to life. It was precisely there, in the stench of fear, the haze of dust, and the deep shadows of his despair, that the angel of the Lord materialized. The angel fixed his gaze on Gideon and delivered a shocking proclamation. "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Mighty warrior?" Gideon glanced frantically around the press. "Me? If the Lord is truly with us?" he challenged, his voice laced with bitterness. "Then why has this crushing disaster befallen us? Where are the legendary miracles our fathers boasted of? Did our God not deliver us from Egypt? Yet now, it feels as though the Lord has utterly abandoned us and delivered us into the hands of Midian." The angel did not engage in theological debate or emotional argument. He issued a clear, sharp command. "Go forth in the strength you already possess. I am sending you now to save Israel from the power of Midian." But Gideon remained unconvinced, clinging to his humility. "My clan is the weakest in Manasseh," he protested, "and I am the most insignificant member of my own family." Still, the unwavering voice replied, "I will be with you, and you will strike down the entire Midianite host as easily as if they were a single defeated man." Needing undeniable proof, Gideon hastily prepared a sacrifice, a feast of tender meat and unleavened bread, and placed it upon a nearby boulder. The angel merely touched the offering with the tip of his staff. Instantly, fire violently erupted from the solid stone, consuming the food in a blinding flash. Then the celestial visitor vanished. Gideon collapsed onto the ground, terrified. "I have seen the Lord face to face," he cried out, but God reassured him. "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. You will not die." In that spot, Gideon erected an altar, naming it Jehovah Shalom, "The Lord is peace." That very night, God gave Gideon his first, treacherous mission. "Go tear down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father. Cut down the sacred Asherah pole standing next to it. Then build a proper altar to me on that high ground and offer the sacrifice." Gideon obeyed, performing the entire, highly provocative act under the cloak of deep night, because even profound bravery must sometimes begin with small, fearful steps. The next morning, the townspeople awoke to an astonishing, sacrilegious sight. Baal's pagan altar lay shattered, the Asherah pole was felled, and a new, unfamiliar altar stood in its place. The people exploded in fury. "Who has done this?" they demanded. Upon discovering the culprit, they shouted, "Bring Gideon out. He must pay with his life." But then Josh, Gideon's own father, the very man who had erected the altar to Baal, found a surprising, sudden courage. "Let Baal defend himself," he declared, challenging the god they worshipped. "If he truly is a god, let him contend." The enraged crowd, baffled by Josh's defiance, slowly backed down. From that pivotal day, Gideon was known as Jerubbaal, meaning, "Let Baal contend." But this confrontation was only the prologue. Soon, the vast valley of Jezreel became choked with hostile forces. Midianites, Amalekites, and other nomadic tribes, armies too countless to even estimate. Then, the Spirit of the Lord descended upon Gideon with undeniable power. He sounded the trumpet, a sharp, rallying call, and summoned the surrounding tribes, and they came. Yet, despite the power he felt, Gideon still wrestled with profound self-doubt. He sought a definitive sign. "If you truly intend to save Israel by my hand," he prayed, "let me place this wool fleece on the ground tonight. Let the fleece be dripping wet with dew, but let the earth around it remain completely dry." The next dawn it was exactly so. Still, uncertainty gnawed at him, so he risked asking again, humbly. This time, let the fleece be dry, and the ground surrounding it soaked with dew. Again, the Almighty answered immediately. The earth was saturated, yet the fleece remained perfectly dry. Now, the man who had been hiding in the winepress was finally ready, not because he had become inherently brave, but because he had received unshakable confirmation for his fragile belief. The valley floor below him was a terrifying ocean of enemies. Midianites, Amalekites, and eastern nomads whose uncountable camels blanketed the landscape, sprawling across the ground like sand along a boundless seashore. Gideon stood above it, still physically trembling. Thousands of Israelites, 32,000 men, had answered his desperate summons and stood behind him. But the Lord had a drastically different strategy in mind. "You have far too many men," the Lord stated plainly. "If you conquer with this overwhelming force, Israel will surely boast, saying, 'We achieved this victory ourselves.' I won't let that happen." So God initiated a trial. "Announce to the people, 'Anyone who is afraid or terrified, let him turn back and go home.'" And 22,000 men, the vast majority, left immediately, melting away just like that. Only 10,000 remained. "Still too many," God decreed. "Take them down to the water. I will test them for you there." Gideon watched. Some men dropped heavily to their knees, burying their faces in the cool stream to drink deeply and carelessly. Others vigilantly scooped the water into their cupped hands, lapping it up quickly, like alert dogs scanning the horizon for danger. Separate those who drank by cupping their hands. That chosen group numbered exactly 300. 300 men against an army beyond counting. God affirmed, "With these 300, I will save Israel and deliver Midian into your power." The remaining thousands were sent home. That night, Gideon was still gripped by a paralyzing fear. So, God offered him a profound grace. "If you are afraid, take your servant Pura and go down to the enemy camp. Just listen to what they are saying." Gideon crept downward, Pura close behind, slipping silently past the perimeter tents and the resting camels, until they were close enough to overhear two soldiers deep in conversation. One man was recounting a strange vision. "I dreamed I saw a humble loaf of barley bread tumble into our camp. It struck a tent, knocking it flat and collapsing the entire structure." The other soldier's face paled in the faint moonlight. "That can only mean one thing," he whispered in dread. "It is the sword of Gideon. God has surrendered our entire host into his hands." Gideon's heart, which moments before had hammered with terror, suddenly soared. He knelt right there, on the foreign enemy soil, and worshipped the God who had orchestrated this divine whisper of confirmation. He breathed a silent, profound thanks, then returned swiftly to his small band of men. He gathered his 300 and presented a battle plan no conventional general would ever have conceived. "Take a trumpet, take a fragile clay jar. Hide a blazing torch inside the jar. Follow my lead." He divided the force into three companies of 100 men each. No swords were drawn. No stealthy surprise attack was planned. Only sound, fire, and unwavering faith. In the dead stillness of the midnight watch, they encircled the massive camp. Gideon gave the crucial signal. Now, 300 trumpets blared deafeningly into the night. 300 clay jars were simultaneously shattered, revealing 300 blazing torches. And together, they shouted the terrifying battle cry, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." The valley instantly erupted into unimaginable chaos. The enemy woke in sheer terror, blinded by the sudden flames, deafened by the shouting, unable to tell friend from foe. They began violently striking each other. Screams echoed across the hills. Horses bolted, camels scattered, and soldiers ran blindly through the darkness. Israel held no weapons in their hands, yet the enemy was already defeated, driven by internal panic. Those Midianites who managed to escape the internal massacre were hunted down relentlessly. Men from Naphtali, Asher, and Ephraim joined the pursuit. Two Midianite princes, Oreb and Zeb, were captured and executed at sites that would forever bear their names. As the dust settled, Gideon's 300 stood victorious. Not due to their overwhelming might or their tactical superiority, but because they had placed their trust in a God who conquers armies with broken pottery and raw courage. They had obeyed when the command made no logical sense, demonstrating that true faith is often about trusting a whisper in the darkest night more than the clear evidence seen in the blazing light of day. The battlefield was now silent, the camels gone, the tents abandoned. But the war was not fully over. Two Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, had escaped with the remnants of their army, and Gideon, driven now by relentless purpose, was far from done. With his 300, he pushed the chase across the River Jordan. Exhausted, painfully hungry, yet driven by an iron will, they arrived at the town of Succoth. Gideon asked the leaders for aid. "Please give my weary men bread. We are still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna." But the leaders sneered contemptuously. "Do you already hold the kings captive? Why should we risk feeding you?" Gideon's face hardened instantly. "When the Lord delivers those kings to me, I will return here and punish you severely with thorns and briars from the desert." He pressed on to Penuel, receiving the same request and the same bitter rejection. "When I return," he warned them, "I will tear down your fortified tower." He kept going, traversing the wilderness and crossing the rough hills until he finally located the kings. Midian's remaining force, still shattered and fearful, was taken completely by surprise, and Gideon captured both Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings responsible for years of cruelty and the murder of his people. He turned back, returning first to Succoth. He brought his proof. "Here they are," he announced to the townsfolk who had mocked him. He seized the elders of the town and taught them a lesson in accountability they would never forget, scourging them harshly with desert thorns. He carried out his threat at Penuel, tearing down their imposing tower. Then he faced the captive kings. "Tell me, what did the men look like whom you killed at Tabor?" The kings met his gaze, replying, "They looked much like you, like the sons of a king." Gideon's composure shattered. "They were my brothers, my own mother's sons," he declared, anguish piercing his voice. "Had you spared them, I would spare you now." He turned to his young son. "Kill them." But the boy, terrified, hesitated. So Gideon stepped forward and, with a single stroke, executed them both. The land was finally pacified, the enemies eradicated, and the people flocked to Gideon. "Rule over us," they begged. "You, your son, and your grandson, you saved us." It was the ultimate moment of political triumph. The crown was within his grasp. But Gideon delivered a response utterly unique for a warlord of his era. "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord alone shall rule over you." He rejected the kingship. Yet, he made one simple request. "Give me each one gold earring from your share of the plunder." They complied lavishly. The gold piled up nearly 40 pounds of precious metal. From this immense treasure, Gideon crafted an ephod, a highly ornate, sacred priestly vestment, and displayed it prominently in his hometown of Ophrah. It was intended as a tribute to God, a relic of their great victory. But tragically, it morphed into something else entirely. People began to venerate it. They bowed before the object, transforming it into a spiritual snare, not only for the populace but for Gideon's own household. Gideon had settled into domestic prosperity, accumulating many wives, 70 legitimate sons, and an ambitious son named Abimelech from a concubine living in Shechem. He lived out his remaining days in peace. The Midianites never again rose up. Gideon, Jerubbaal, died old and celebrated. But as soon as he was laid to rest, the fickle people reverted instantly to their old ways. They ran after the Baals, forgetting the Lord, forgetting Gideon, forgetting the hard-won lessons of their history. The final test, it seemed, was not the external battle against Midian, but the internal battle for sustained fidelity. After Gideon's death, the peace was temporary and fragile. Abimelech, Gideon's son by the Shechemite concubine, harbored a consuming, corrosive ambition. Not satisfied to be one of 70 potential successors, he sought absolute power. He approached his mother's powerful relatives in Shechem. "Which is better for you, to be ruled by 70 men, all the numerous sons of Gideon, or by one man, who is your own flesh and blood?" The ambitious people of Shechem, swayed by kinship and the promise of consolidated power, chose Abimelech. They provided him with 70 silver shekels stolen from the temple of Baal-berith. With this blood money, Abimelech hired ruthless, desperate mercenaries, men without conscience. He marched to Ophrah, his father's town, and on one terrible stone, he brutally murdered all 70 of his brothers. Only Jotham, the youngest son, managed to escape the slaughter. Abimelech was promptly crowned king beside the great oak tree at the pillar in Shechem. But Jotham, having survived the massacre, scaled Mount Gerizim and shouted down a blistering parable to the people of Shechem. He told the story of the trees seeking a sovereign. They asked the noble olive tree, the sweet fig tree, and the joyous grapevine, but all politely declined, unwilling to abandon their fruitful purpose for the burdens of rule. Finally, they asked the worthless thorn bush, which readily accepted, saying menacingly, "If you truly wish to anoint me, take refuge in my shade. But if not, beware. Fire will come forth from the thorn bush to consume the cedars of Lebanon." Jotham warned, "If you have acted honestly and honorably in making Abimelech your king, then may you find joy in him. But if you have not, may fire come forth from Abimelech to consume you, and may fire come forth from you to consume him." Then Jotham fled quickly into exile. Abimelech reigned over Israel for 3 turbulent years. Then, the inevitable hand of divine retribution fell. God sent an evil spirit of bitter discord between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. They violently turned against their chosen king. Gaal, son of Ebed, moved into Shechem and openly challenged Abimelech's authority. Zebul, the city's governor and Abimelech's loyal ally, secretly sent word to Abimelech. Abimelech cunningly set an ambush. As Gaal stood arrogantly at the city gate, Abimelech's forces attacked, driving Gaal and his supporters out. The next day, when the Shechemites went into the fields, Abimelech divided his men into 3 companies and unleashed a brutal attack. He captured the city, massacred its inhabitants, and grimly sowed the ground with salt, symbolically cursing it forever. The leaders of Shechem who survived the initial onslaught took refuge in the Tower of El-Berith. Abimelech quickly gathered wood, piled it against the tower, and set it ablaze, incinerating nearly 1,000 men and women inside. Next, Abimelech moved on to Thebes. The people there fled to a formidable inner tower. As Abimelech approached the tower base, intending to replicate his fiery success, a nameless woman on the battlements dropped a heavy upper millstone directly onto his head, brutally fracturing his skull. Mortally wounded, he desperately called out to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me, so they can't say a woman killed me." His servant obeyed, running him through with the sword, and he died. Thus, God fully repaid Abimelech for the monstrous evil he had committed against his own father by murdering his 70 brothers. God also ensured that the wicked people of Shechem paid for their complicity in the crime. After the fiery horror of Abimelech's short, bloody reign subsided, and the blood dried in Shechem streets, Israel desperately needed healing. Not a warrior king, not a man consumed by vengeance, but simply a steady leader who could restore calm. That man was Tola, from the tribe of Issachar. He lived quietly in the hill country of Ephraim, in the town of Shamir. He was not celebrated for grand conquests or dramatic acts of iconoclasm. He judged Israel for 23 years, a long, quiet era of balanced justice and steadiness. Sometimes, God delivers necessary change not with a trumpet blast, but with a firm, enduring whisper. When Tola died, he was buried in Shamir. Then came Jair the Gileadite. His name, ironically, meant he shines. He had 30 sons, each riding on a stately donkey, each holding dominion over one of 30 towns in Gilead. 30 sons, 30 towns, they aptly named the region Havoth Jair, the villages of Jair. Jair judged Israel for 22 years. He, too, was known less for epic battles and more for standing faithfully in the widening gap, leading quietly while others forgot their covenant. He simply held Israel together, just long enough. Then Jair died and was buried in common. These two men, Tola and Jair, were not the spectacular figures like Gideon or Deborah. They were God's enduring choices, demonstrating that often, the mightiest leaders are those who simply remain reliably faithful when the rest of the nation forgets how. In the rugged, demanding lands of Gilead lived a man named Jephthah. He was formidable, highly skilled, and respected for his raw courage, yet he remained a permanent outcast. The reason? Jephthah was the son of a prostitute. His father, Gilead, had other sons with his legitimate wife, and when they matured, they cruelly drove Jephthah away. "You'll have no share in our inheritance," they declared. "You're not really one of us." So Jephthah fled, settling in the distant land of Tob. There, a strange destiny unfolded. Other outcasts gravitated toward him. Men with no homes, no reputation, rough men and dedicated fighters. Jephthah quickly became their commander. The man who was cast away became an indispensable leader. The man who was shamed forged himself into someone you did not dare cross. Years passed. Then the Ammonites attacked Israel. Their army massed like a destructive thunderstorm gathering on the eastern borders. Suddenly, the self-righteous leaders of Gilead frantically remembered Jephthah. They traveled to Tob to plead with him. "Come, lead our army," they begged. "Fight for us." Jephthah stared them down, his voice steady. "Didn't you hate me? Didn't you drive me away? Now you want me back?" They groveled. "We need you, and if you come, we'll make you head over all of Gilead." Jephthah agreed, but made them solemnly swear the promise before the Lord. And they did. The outcast came home as commander and judge. But before lifting his sword, Jephthah attempted diplomacy, sending messengers to the king of Ammon. "Why are you attacking us?" The king claimed, "Israel stole our land when they came from Egypt. Return it now." Jephthah sent back a powerful, historically accurate reply. "We asked to pass peacefully. Your allied nations blocked us. We didn't seize your land. Our God gave it to us after centuries of peace. You've had 300 years to claim it. Why claim it back now? I haven't wronged you. You're the one provoking this senseless fight." The king arrogantly ignored him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. He marched through Gilead and Manasseh to the Ammonite border. But before the battle began, Jephthah made a dangerous, terrible vow. "Lord, if you grant me victory over the Ammonites, I promise to offer as a burnt sacrifice whatever comes out of my house first to greet me when I return." He fought. He conquered 20 towns. The Ammonites were utterly crushed. Israel was temporarily safe. But when Jephthah returned home, the first person who ran out to meet him was his daughter, his only child, dancing and celebrating, innocently unaware of the fatal promise. Jephthah collapsed, utterly broken. "Oh, my daughter, you have shattered my spirit. I made a vow to the Lord, and I can't rescind it." She did not weep or plead. She replied with astonishing courage, "Father, if you have made a promise to the Lord, you must keep it. But grant me 2 months to retreat to the hills and mourn the life I will never have." He allowed her the time. When she returned, he kept his dreadful vow. A monumental victory eternally wrapped in devastating heartbreak. Forever after, the young women of Israel would annually commemorate her courage. The man they threw away became the man they needed most. But his story serves as a harsh reminder that words spoken in haste, even in faith, can cost everything. The victory over Ammon should have brought peace, but tribal pride always demands a reckoning. After the battle, the powerful tribe of Ephraim stormed in, furious. They confronted Jephthah, shouting, "Why didn't you call us to fight the Ammonites with you? We're going to burn your house down." Jephthah stood firm, restraining his anger. "I did call you. You didn't come. So I risked my life and fought without you, and the Lord delivered the victory. Why accuse me now?" But the Ephraimites were blinded by their wounded pride. They hated being overlooked and outshined. Worst of all, they hurled venomous insults at Jephthah's people, the Gileadites. "You're just runaways from Ephraim," they sneered. "You don't belong to a real tribe." Insults swiftly escalated to threats, and words dissolved into civil war. Jephthah had no choice. He called his warriors, and a tragic battle erupted between brothers. The Gileadites soundly defeated Ephraim's forces. To prevent their escape, they seized control of the crossing points on the Jordan River. Every man trying to cross was stopped and subjected to a lethal test. Say the word, Shibboleth. But the Ephraimites, due to their unique dialect, could not pronounce the SH sound correctly. They could only say Shibboleth. That tiny, phonetic difference meant everything. It instantly revealed who was friend and who was foe. On that riverbank, 42,000 Ephraimites were slaughtered by their own kin, not by Canaanites or Philistines, but by Israelites. It marked one of the darkest hours in Israel's history, when jealousy outweighed unity and pride proved deadlier than any foreign enemy. Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years more, then died. The man who stood against outsiders ultimately had to stand against his own people. Not every chapter of history is loud. Not every leader carries a sword. Some simply hold the nation steady when the foundation is shaking. After Jephthah's turbulent era, Israel was fragile, exhausted by both foreign wars and internal conflict. Stability was paramount. God provided three quiet judges. First, Ibsen of Bethlehem. He judged Israel for 7 years. We know of no great military feats, but we do know this. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters, whom he strategically married outside his immediate clan, bringing in wives for his sons from outside as well. This wasn't military conquest. It was wisdom, building peace and forging alliances one strategic household at a time. When he died, he was buried in Bethlehem. Then came Elon from the tribe of Zebulun, judging Israel for 10 years, a calm leader from a modest tribe. No battles, no monuments, just a decade of quiet calm. Sometimes, lasting peace is the greatest victory. After Elon came Abdon, son of Hillel, from the town of Pirathon. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, and they rode on 70 donkeys, a significant marker of wealth and nobility. Abdon judged Israel for 8 years. His leadership, like the donkeys his family rode, was steady, practical, and deeply rooted. He was not flashy, but he maintained the precious peace. And often, maintaining peace in a nation perpetually on the verge of internal rebellion is the most demanding task of all. Three judges, three quiet chapters. No thrones, no swords. Just men who successfully filled the void between chaos and order, long enough for the next, dramatic hero to emerge. Israel sinned yet again, falling back into disobedience. And yet again, God gave them over, this time into the relentless grip of the Philistines. For 40 crushing years, the Philistines ruled over Israel, oppressing, humiliating, and growing bolder with every passing season. But even amidst this prolonged subjugation, God harbored a distinct plan. Not through a massive army, nor through a political king, but through a baby. In the rugged hill country of Dan lived a man named Manoah. His wife was barren, unable to bear children, until one pivotal day when an angel of the Lord appeared to her. "You are going to conceive and give birth to a son," the angel declared. "He must be set apart to God from the moment of his birth as a Nazirite. No wine is to pass his lips, no unclean food is to touch him, and no razor must ever touch his head. He will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hand of the Philistines." The woman rushed to tell her husband, and Manoah immediately prayed, "Lord, let this man return and teach us how to raise the child." The divine messenger returned to the fields of Zorah. And when Manoah, overwhelmed with reverence, tried to offer him a meal, the angel firmly redirected him, "Offer it to the Lord alone." As Manoah prepared the sacrifice, the fire flared upward, and in a terrifying, glorious vision, the angel of the Lord ascended in the smoke and the roaring flames, vanishing into the sky. Manoah fell instantly to the earth, his face pressed against the dust, consumed by primal fear. "We have seen God. We are surely going to die." But his wife, calmer and possessed of clearer spiritual insight, gently replied, "If the Lord had intended for us to die, he would not have accepted our offering and revealed these wonders to us." Later, she carried and gave birth to a boy. They named him Samson, and the powerful, restless spirit of the Lord began immediately to stir within him. He was a Nazirite from the womb, consecrated, chosen, anointed, set apart for a singular, destructive purpose. Yet, Samson's staggering physical strength would always exist in painful tension with his profound moral weakness. His divine calling was constantly at war with his base human desires. And that internal war was only just beginning. Samson grew into a fearsome man, strong not only in muscle and stature but also in youthful confidence, a confidence that often bordered on reckless arrogance. One day, yielding to curiosity and lust, he descended into Timnah, a vibrant Philistine city, the very heart of the enemy's territory. There he saw her, a Philistine woman, stunningly beautiful, undeniably captivating, and completely, utterly forbidden by the law. He rushed home, his decision already made, and declared to his bewildered parents, "I saw a woman in Timnah. She is the one I want. Go and secure her for me." His parents were aghast. "Can you not marry someone from within our own tribe, from the daughters of your people? Why must you take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson, stubbornly insistent, repeated the command. "She is the one who pleases me. Get her." What none of them realized was that this impulsive, reckless desire, this choice driven by lust, was secretly being woven into God's larger, complex plan to provoke and confront the oppressive Philistines. Reluctantly, his parents went to arrange the marriage negotiations. On the way down, Samson walked ahead, venturing through a nearby vineyard. Suddenly, with a terrifying roar, a young lion leaped out of the thicket, charging him. In a flash, the overwhelming spirit of the Lord descended upon Samson, empowering him beyond human limits. With nothing but his bare hands, he grabbed the savage beast and tore it apart as easily as one would tear a kid goat. He said nothing of this brutal incident to his parents. Days later, returning to the same spot, curiosity made him turn aside to look at the lion's carcass. To his surprise, he found a swarm of bees had made a hive inside the dried remains, and they had filled it with wild honey. Samson scooped out the forbidden sweetness with his hands, eating it as he walked, and gave some to his unknowing parents without revealing where the unexpected delicacy had originated. The wedding feast finally arrived, stretching out over 7 days, and with it came a challenge rooted in his secret. Samson stood before 30 Philistine men and made a wager. "Allow me to pose a riddle. If you can solve it within these 7 days, I will give you 30 expensive linen tunics and 30 sets of festive clothing. But if you cannot, then you must give me 30 sets of clothing." They readily agreed, and he gave the riddle. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. The Philistines debated, argued, and puzzled over the cryptic words for days. Unable to solve the mystery through wit, they resorted to vile coercion. They went to Samson's new wife and threatened her. "Use your charms to trick him into telling you the answer. If you do not, we will burn you and your father's entire house down." Day after day, she dissolved into tears, begged, pleaded, and nagged him relentlessly, wearing down his resolve. Finally, on the 7th day, Samson, exhausted by her manipulation, gave in and told her the secret. She immediately ran to the Philistines. Before the sun set that day, they returned with the solution. "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" Samson's eyes narrowed, instantly recognizing the treachery. He knew they couldn't have solved it honestly. "If you had not plowed with my heifer," he sneered, using a common derogatory idiom, "you would not have solved my riddle." The spirit of the Lord rushed upon him yet again. Driven by humiliation and rage, he stormed into the nearby Philistine city of Ashkelon, slaughtered 30 innocent men, stripped them of their fine clothing, and returned to pay his debt to the wedding guests. Then, consumed by anger, feeling utterly betrayed and publicly humiliated, he abandoned his new wife and went home to his father's house. The Philistines, seeing their chance, compounded the insult by giving Samson's wife to the best man, his wedding companion. This was no mere heartbreak. This was the spark that ignited the war. Some emotional wounds cut far deeper than any blade. When Samson finally returned to Timnah, his heart still bruised and his anger still simmering beneath the surface, he brought a peace offering, a young goat, with the intention of visiting his wife. but her father blocked his entry. I assumed that you utterly hated her when you left. I have already given her to your best man. But look, her younger sister is much prettier. You can marry her instead. Samson's jaw clenched, the residual pain igniting into a consuming fury. This time, he announced, his voice thick with cold menace. I cannot be blamed for the devastation I am about to inflict upon the Philistines. And with that grim promise, he vanished into the wilderness hills. What he did next was shocking, a calculated act of terror. Samson captured 300 wild foxes. He meticulously tied them together in pairs, tail to tail, and between each pair, he fastened a burning torch. Then he released them, letting them stream loose across the Philistine agricultural land. The flames raced through the mature grain fields, searing the vineyards, and scorching the olive groves. Everything burned. It was an inferno of widespread revenge. The Philistines were left stunned by the scale of the destruction. "Who did this?" they demanded. Someone whispered the name, "Samson," because they gave his wife away. So the Philistines, acting with the reflexive cruelty of oppressive men, sought the easiest target. They blamed the woman and her family. They dragged her and her father out and burned them alive. When Samson received the news, he did not weep. He did not flee. He responded with a chilling vow. "Since this is what you have done, I swear I will not stop until I have exacted full revenge on you." And he struck again, a fierce, relentless slaughter, killing a great number of Philistines in a brutal rampage. Afterward, he retreated and disappeared into a cave in the rock of Etam, high in the territory of Judah. But the Philistines were not finished. They invaded Judah, spreading out and demanding, "We are here looking for Samson." The men of Judah, his own people, fearing the wrath of their overlords, came to the cave. "Why are you doing this to us?" they pleaded. Samson stood defiant. "I only did to them what they first did to me." The Judahites, desperate and beaten down, begged him, "We have no choice, we have to turn you over. The Philistines rule over us." Samson forced a promise from them. "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." They tied him with two new, strong, supposedly unbreakable ropes and led him out to hand him over to the enemy. As he approached, the Philistines raised a joyful, triumphant shout. But suddenly, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him with unstoppable force. The new ropes fell from his arms like burnt thread, dissolving in an instant. He grabbed the closest weapon he could find, the fresh jawbone of a donkey, and with this crude implement he struck down 1,000 men. Breathless, standing over a sea of enemies, he bellowed his battle cry. "With a donkey's jawbone, I made them into heaps. With a donkey's jawbone, I killed 1,000 men." He dropped the bloody bone and named the place Ramoth Lehi, or Jawbone Hill. But even heroes are bound by mortal limits, and Samson was consumed by a desperate thirst. "Lord," he cried out, his voice hoarse, "you granted me this incredible victory, and now I am going to die here of thirst." God, responding to his plea, miraculously split open a hollow place in the ground, and cool water gushed out. Samson drank deeply, and his spirit was instantly revived. He named the spring En-Hakkor, the spring of the caller. From that moment, Samson judged Israel for 20 turbulent years. A powerful warrior, an anarchic rebel, a destructive storm in human skin, yet still a man chosen and ordained by God. Samson was the strongest man in Israel, but he still harbored that fatal weakness, not for war, but for alluring beauty. One day he traveled to Gaza, venturing deep into the heartland of Philistine territory. There he spent the night with a local woman. The Philistines heard of his presence and instantly set a trap. "At dawn we strike," they agreed. They sealed the towering city gates, locking the massive iron doors and surrounding the area. But Samson woke at midnight. Instead of trying to sneak out quietly, he walked deliberately to the city gates. Two colossal doors of iron and stone, reinforced with giant posts. He tore them from their hinges, locks and all. He hoisted the entire structure onto his shoulders and carried them, a spectacular, impossible burden, to the top of a hill facing Hebron. He wasn't just escaping. He was sending an undeniable message. Asterisk, you cannot contain me. But even giants can be brought low by a persistent, calculated lure. And for Samson, that lethal lure was a woman named Delilah. She lived in the Valley of Sorek, and once again, Samson fell hopelessly in love. The Philistine rulers saw their final, best opportunity. They came to Delilah with a sinister promise. Find out the secret source of his phenomenal strength. How can he be overpowered and bound? If you succeed, we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. Delilah smiled, agreeing to the immense bribe. She didn't need to fight him. She only needed to ask. Samson, she began, feigning intimacy. What makes you so strong? How could someone finally tie you up and make you weak? He played with her, treating it as a game. Tie me securely with 7 fresh, never used bowstrings. Then I'll be as weak as any other man. That night, while he slept, she did exactly that. And when the Philistine soldiers burst into the chamber, she cried, Samson, the Philistines are here. He snapped the bowstrings effortlessly, like burned thread. Delilah pouted. You lied to me. Tell me the truth. He grinned. New ropes and used by man. That would surely work. She tried again with the same result. Weave my 7 locks of hair tightly into the fabric of your loom, he suggested next. She did. He woke and broke free again, pulling the entire loom away from the wall. But Delilah was relentless. Day after day, she begged, pleaded, and cried, using emotional warfare until Samson was tired to the point of death. Finally, worn down, he gave her the ultimate prize, his trust, his heart, and his truth. I have been a Nazarite, consecrated to God, since the day of my birth, he confessed. If my head is shaved, my strength will leave me, and I will become powerless, like any other man. She knew, deep in her wicked heart, that he was serious this time. She sent word instantly to the Philistine lords. Come one last time. He has told me everything. That night, she lulled him gently to sleep on her lap. As he slumbered, oblivious, a man came in and shaved off the 7 braided locks of his hair. Then she whispered the fatal warning. Samson, the Philistines are here. He woke up, ready to surge with power, thinking, I will break free and shake myself clear, just like before. But he did not know, he could not feel, that the Lord had finally departed from him. They grabbed him immediately, overpowering him easily. They blinded him by gouging out his eyes, bound him tightly in heavy bronze chains, and threw him into the prison house. The once mighty judge of Israel was reduced to a sightless slave, grinding grain in the humiliating darkness. But in that silence, in that deep pit of darkness and despair, a quiet miracle was slowly occurring. His hair began to grow back. Samson, once feared by entire armies, was now nothing but a trophy, blind, bound, and seemingly forgotten by his God. The Philistines could not contain their joy at having brought the mighty champion low, so they scheduled a massive feast in the temple of their god, Dagon. Thousands gathered, rulers, nobles, and spectators. They drank, they cheered, and then someone shouted, Bring out Samson, let him entertain us with his humiliation. So they brought him, the man who had once torn a lion apart with his bare hands, now stumbling, guided pathetically by a young servant boy. They mocked him, laughed at his misery, and paraded him through the surging crowd like a cheap prize. Then Samson whispered to the boy, Please, put my hands on the 2 central pillars that hold up the whole temple. I need to rest against them. He was led to the 2 main columns, the colossal supports holding the roof above the thousands of revelers. And there, in that place of ultimate humiliation, he prayed. Not loud, not proud, but a prayer that was raw and desperately real. Sovereign Lord, remember me. Strengthen me just this once. O God, that I may just this once avenge my 2 eyes on the Philistines. With both hands, he reached out, braced his blind body, and pushed with all his might. Let me die with the Philistines. The massive pillars groaned. The ceiling cracked. The entire temple structure collapsed in a deafening, catastrophic roar. Stone, wood, and screams filled the air. Samson's final act was his most destructive and his most powerful. He killed more Philistines in his death than he ever had during his entire life. And under the rubble, his enemies were gone. So was he. Later, his brothers came. They found his body among the ruins and carried him away. They buried him in the tomb of his father, Manoah. The man they buried, a paradox of calling and chaos, had judged Israel for 20 years. This is a story of astounding strength, yes, but also a story of crippling weakness, profound failure, and ultimate grace. Because even in his brokenness and self-destruction, God used him to deliver Israel. And sometimes, God's greatest victories are born from our lowest, darkest places. The narrative shifts abruptly, illustrating the deepening moral rot of the nation. In the remote hill country of Ephraim lived a man named Micah. One day, he confessed to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen from you, I have them. I took them." His mother, instead of condemning him, immediately responded, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." She then dedicated the recovered silver to the Lord, instructing that a substantial portion be used to craft a carved image and a metal idol. So Micah took the money, and from it, a religious figurine was fashioned. He set up an elaborate shrine in his own house, created an ephod and household gods, teraphim, and unilaterally ordained one of his own sons to serve as his private priest. In those days, the foundational problem was simple and devastating. There was no king in Israel. Everyone, from the strongest judge to the common citizen, did what was right in his own eyes. A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah was traveling, seeking a more permanent place to settle and earn a living. He happened to arrive at Micah's house. Micah saw him and seized the opportunity. "Stay here with me," Micah offered warmly. "Be a father and a priest to my household, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver per year, a complete suit of clothes, and all your provisions." The Levite, pragmatic and eager for stability, agreed immediately. Micah consecrated him, and the young man became his priest. Micah declared confidently, "Now I know without a doubt that the Lord will prosper me, because I have secured a Levite as my personal priest." But this was not the true worship God had commanded. It was a man-made religion, a cynical blend of convenience, truth, and terrible error. During this time, the tribe of Dan was desperately seeking new territory to settle their large population. They sent 5 men ahead to explore the land. These spies came to Micah's house and recognized the distinct accent of the young Levite. They stopped and asked him, "Who brought you here? What exactly are you doing in this private place?" He happily told them about his comfortable arrangement with Micah. The men then asked, "Please inquire of God for us, to learn whether our journey will be successful." The opportunistic priest replied easily, "Go in peace. The journey you are undertaking is under the Lord's watchful eye." The spies continued their reconnaissance and found the city of Laish, a people living in security, quiet, and completely unsuspecting. They returned to their tribe and reported enthusiastically, "Let's attack them. The land is magnificent, rich and wide, and God has surely given it into our hands." So 600 heavily armed Danite warriors set out toward the north. When they reached Micah's house, the 5 spies who had previously surveyed the land addressed the army. "Do you realize that in these houses nearby there is an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a cast idol? Now you know what to do." They entered Micah's dwelling and brazenly took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the cast idol. The Levite priest, startled by the invasion, challenged them, "What are you doing? Stop." The Danites answered with a threat and a lucrative offer, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us all. Isn't it far better to serve an entire tribe and clan in Israel as a priest, rather than just one man's small household?" The Levite priest was easily swayed. He was thrilled. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the carved image, and walked away with the 600 men. Micah soon discovered the theft. He gathered his neighbors and furiously pursued the Danites. He cried out to the departing army, "You took my gods that I made, and you took my priest, and you have simply gone away. What do I have left?" The Danites replied with harsh intimidation, "Don't argue with us, Micah, or some of our hot-tempered men will attack you, and you will certainly lose your life." Micah saw that they were far too strong for him. Humiliated and defeated, he turned back and went home. The Danites took what Micah had made and the greedy priest who had belonged to him, and continued on to Laish. They attacked the city with merciless force, put the peaceful inhabitants to the sword, and burned the entire city down. They rebuilt the settlement and settled there, renaming the city Dan. They immediately set up the stolen carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons served as priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. They continued to use the idol Micah had made all the time the proper house of God was located in Shiloh. This entire episode is a tragic story of stolen religion, of personal, convenient worship replacing divine command, of a tribe choosing expansion over covenant, and of a nation doing what was right in their own eyes. The book descends into its darkest episode. There was a certain Levite living in the remote, less governed hills of Ephraim. He had taken for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but she proved unfaithful to him. She left him and returned to her father's house. After 4 months, driven by desire or proprietary rights, he went after her to win her back. Her father welcomed him with open arms, urging him to stay longer and celebrate. They ate, they laughed, and they delayed their departure, day after day. But on the fifth day, the Levite finally insisted, "We must leave now." They set out in the late evening, making poor time. When they reached the city of Gibeah, in the territory of Benjamin, it was late and dark, and they desperately needed a place to stay. Shamefully, no one in the city offered them hospitality until an old man, returning late from the fields, saw them. "Come with me," he offered. "Do not spend the night unprotected in the public square." They went into his home. They ate, refreshed themselves, and rested. But as the night deepened, pure evil arrived. Wicked men, a vicious mob, surrounded the house. They banged violently on the door and shouted their terrifying demand, "Bring out the man who came into your house. We want to abuse him." The old man, horrified by the gross violation of hospitality, begged, "No, do not commit this wicked, vile thing. This man is my guest." Then, in a moment of utter moral collapse, he offered them his own virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine instead. The men seized the concubine. They dragged her out, abused her, and raped her all through the night. When the sun finally rose, she collapsed at the door of the old man's house. When the Levite opened the door to leave, he found her lying there, motionless. He commanded callously, "Get up, let's go." But there was no reply. She was gone, violated and dead. He carried her ravaged body home. And then, in a state of shock, grief, and incandescent rage, he did the unthinkable. He took a knife and cut her into 12 separate pieces. He sent a piece to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. The message was unmistakable and searing. "Look what has been done in Israel." The tribes gathered, 400,000 soldiers stood before the Lord at Mizpah. They heard the Levites' horrifying story, and they were enraged. They sent messengers to the tribe of Benjamin. "Give up the wicked men of Gibeah who did this atrocious thing. Let us purge this evil from our land." But the tribe of Benjamin refused to hand over their criminals. Instead, they armed themselves and prepared for war against their own brothers. And so, brother stood against brother. Israel marched out, and the devastating civil war began. On day one, Benjamin struck down 22,000 Israelites. On day two, 18,000 more fell. The nation wept and consulted the Lord, refusing to give up. On the third day, Israel set a cunning trap. They burned the city of Gibeah and cornered Benjamin's warriors. 25,000 Benjamites were slaughtered in the fields. Only 600 survivors managed to hide, fleeing into the remote wilderness. Then Israel, fueled by vengeance and despair, turned on the remaining towns of Benjamin, burning, killing, and erasing everything in their path. After the endless bloodshed, terrible sorrow finally set in. The tribes gathered and wept before the Lord. "One tribe is nearly gone. What have we done?" They remembered the oath they had sworn in their righteous fury. "No daughter of ours will ever marry a Benjamite." But now they desperately needed to save the remnant. They found one town, Jabesh-Gilead, that had failed to join the assembly for the war. They attacked it, killed everyone except 400 young virgins, and these women became wives for the 600 Benjamite survivors. But it still was not enough. So they devised a final, desperate plan. During the annual festival in Shiloh, they instructed the unmarried girls would dance in the vineyards. "Let the remaining Benjamites hide," they said. "And when the girls come out to dance, each man should rush out and seize a wife. Then go and rebuild your towns." And that is exactly what they did. The Benjamites took their stolen wives, rebuilt their desolate towns, and returned to their land. And the book of Judges ends with a single, haunting sentence. A sentence that explains everything that happened from Samson's lust to the war in Gibeah. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." The book of Judges is not merely history. It is a mirror, a dark window into the soul of a nation spiraling downward. What began with Joshua's faithful conquest ended in chaos, civil war, and moral cannibalism. They had the land, they had the law, they had the stories of miracles and deliverance. But they lacked the one thing that mattered most: a heart that remembered and revered God's commands. We watched them win spectacular battles, only to fall immediately to cheap idols. We watched them cry out to God in desperation, only to forget him the moment peace returned. Each judge brought a fleeting hope: Othniel, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson. But each story demonstrated the exact same cycle, intensified each time. Disobedience, followed by disaster, leading to desperation, followed by deliverance, and then disobedience again. The cycle never broke. It only spiraled deeper into depravity. They didn't just need another deliverer, another temporary warrior. They needed a king. Not just someone to save them from external enemies, but someone to lead and rule their hearts. Not just a warrior, but a shepherd. One who could finally, permanently break the cycle of human failure. And centuries later, that promised king would come. Born not in earthly power, but humbly in a stable. He would ride not on a war chariot, but on a borrowed donkey. He would wear not a crown of gold, but a crown of thorns. And he would defeat not merely nations, but sin, death, and hell itself. His name was Jesus, the true and final judge, the king they longed for, the king we still desperately need. The book of Judges ends in total darkness, but it points irrevocably to the light. A people lost, a God who never gave up, a story waiting for ultimate redemption. And the question remains: in a world where everyone still does what is right in their own eyes, will you choose the way of the king?